Welcome to Small World, Big Problems, a podcast from the Philip Merrill Center of Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. I am your host, Sanjana Pola Pragada. Today, we will look at an unconventional but increasingly popular path, starting up your own business in the national security space or national security startups. We are joined by two extraordinary guests today, both graduates of Johns Hopkins SAIS, who have been at the forefront of this transformation, Rob Miller and Emma Bates. Rob Miller is the author of Startup Statesman, has over two decades of experience in the U.S. government, with assignments across Capitol Hill, the White House, and the intelligence community. After public service, he helped launch Hawkeye 360, now valued at over $1 billion, and later Crowd AI, which was acquired by the defense giant Saab. Next, Emma Bates is the CEO and founder of Kachai, a dual-use software startup specializing in collaborative autonomy. Her career spans the Army Futures Command, the Center for Strategic International Studies, the Defense Innovation Unit, and the private sector. Hello, guys. Hi, Rob and Emma. How are you doing today?
Great, thank you.
Hi, doing great.
Well, thank you so much for being here to talk with us today. And I know that as SAIS alumni, how does it feel kind of coming back to SAIS virtually through this podcast, speaking to students where your own journeys have started right here?
Feels great. I actually got to visit the new Bloomberg Center about a week ago to give a speech. And it was really cool to see the location and just the wonderful architecture and art that current students get to enjoy. I'm a little jealous.
A lot better than a couple of years ago.
We never went there for the architecture and art and location on the mall, but it's just exciting to see either way. It's a place where things are happening.
Definitely.
Rob, what do you think?
I agree. I love coming back to SAIS. I felt like when I was at school, it was the first time I truly felt at home living in Washington, D.C., where I really met a large cohort of peers. And, the new building is obviously exciting and different. But having been in the old building in DuPont Circle, I do feel like a little bit has been lost. I love that neighborhood.
Hey, we have the best of both experiences here. And I know this is a hardcore international relations school. So did you imagine one day you would be building your own startup or advising startups in the broader defense and government space?
Not at all. I thought I was going to be a govy for life.
Like most people, yeah. You come in here, one pathway, you're like, we're going to do this for the rest of our life.
I definitely thought I was going to be a govy. I thought I was going to be some kind of peace negotiator. Went into SAIS and realized, I actually really like this strategic studies business. let's lean into that. And then, but never did I think I was going to be founding a startup. That was just, it was like, well, that's what I have to do in order to solve the problem that I see.
What first sparked your interest in national security entrepreneurship? So in terms of solving this problem, was there a specific aha moment, you know, that led to you founding your first startup, Emma?
Yeah, the aha moment was really when I started to notice that some of the problems that I was seeing across various military modernization programs, like, you know, collaborative combat aircraft, swarming, the replicator program, you know, all of these different attempts at using a lot of smaller platforms instead of one large platform, like one big aircraft carrier, they were all running into the same problem of how do we get them all to work together at machine speed when they might not have a great connection back to some ground control station or operator or the cloud. And so that when I started to realize that was the same problem across a lot of different programs, that was an aha moment.
And you mentioned swarming. Could you just explain for the audience what this means? Just like simple terms for anyone who's unfamiliar.
Yeah, I think that the word has expanded a lot and changed a lot. I see it as a step change in strategy where you move from things moving at human speed and individually, and therefore having to work really hard to coordinate themselves, whether they're autonomous or manned, right? To a paradigm where you have hundreds or thousands of smaller devices that are actually acting as one, right? And I think a true swarm is strategically powerful if it can continue to adapt to changing circumstances quickly at machine speed and intelligently, down to the last remaining unit. In other words, degrade very gracefully. There's been a lot of attention on manufacturing for swarming, as you know, you need the numbers. But you know, if we can't figure out how to get them to really work together, then all you have is just a big marching band, right? Which gets defeated by any adversary that figures out how to do what I consider to be true swarming, that resilient, disconnected, but still acting as one large group of things that are intelligently able to figure out how to adapt to changing circumstances.
I remember you gave this example in one of your talks of just the drone show that they do in China, like of a dragon. And if the head of the dragon comes off or stops working, can the rest of the body assimilate? Does it know how to fit into the next pattern individually and together? Is that kind of the technology surrounding that?
Yeah, it, you know, you see really amazing what, again, I call kind of marching band style swarming, where there are thousands of individual drones or platforms of some kind that are executing something in a pre-programmed fashion, and they're just using GPS, and they're good at not hitting each other, right? But really, the mission for them is to create this image in the sky. And, you know, if you take it a step further into the real world of strategy, let's say, you know, someone reaches out with a giant King Kong hand and just like takes away all the drones that made up the head of that dragon. The rest of the drones cannot reassemble to achieve the mission. Do you know what I mean? Like they're going to be headless. There are no drones. There's no way for them to decide amongst themselves, okay, I'll go over here and be part of a new head, or we can reassemble as a smaller version, or, you know, some way to adapt to the changed circumstance. That the whole paradigm just can't handle that. And so that to me doesn't really give you the strategic benefit of true swarming.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And the implications specifically in the space of defense, what would that look like just in a more apt way? Like how, what could we see potentially with these drones?
Sure. So a concept of operations that makes, I think, a lot of sense for a swarming approach is, say, a complex search and rescue, but also potentially, you know, target enemy actors kind of situation where you're trying to defend some things and attack other things. And you're also being attacked yourself. And so if you want to automate that and keep humans back, you know, at a distance, you know, you want those, you don't want first person view drone swarms, because then the humans have to coordinate amongst themselves, right? They're providing the common operating picture, but all they have is that video feed. What you really want is for the drones themselves to self-orchestrate. And even better, if the human can just say, look, here's what, you know, civilians that need rescuing look like, and here's what adversaries look like. And ask us permission, like don't shoot anybody unless you're connected back to us, because we do have to give, you know, there has to be a human on the loop for that. But when you're disconnected, you know, go find civilians and bring them to safety, or go map out the disaster zone, or go and tell us where you think the adversaries are. And then as individuals in that swarm get removed, say by getting shot down or using themselves as a, you know, as a kinetic one-way attack device, then the rest of the swarm is able to say, okay, we have fewer of us, So let's spread out in a different way to cover the same area. That's the kind of use case that you would want. And what's really crucial is, you know, you can't expect them to always be connected back to the operator, back to home base. So they have to be able to do some of that adaptive negotiation amongst themselves over peer-to-peer comms, especially because in this kind of situation, you're probably not going to have, you know, really long-range communications. And so that's really kind of one of the main use cases. That adaptability makes it so that they're not just kind of, you know, driving at a single goal while ignoring other goals and ignoring the need to prioritize and readjust when things change.
Okay, okay. And keeping with this theme of adaptability, so I just wanted to establish a baseline for our viewers. So going back in this journey, right, before you got the company itself and realized there's a gap in this technology, for the students or audiences that have a startup themselves or a concrete and monetizable idea, I wanted to ask both of you guys, was there a particular experience working with or around government systems that shaped how you saw inefficiencies or opportunities for innovation? Let's start with Rob.
Sure. So I guess the first sort of major moment was working at the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, which analyzes satellite reconnaissance imagery, and appreciating that our exquisite systems were not only, let's say, few, but also exceedingly expensive. And so there was a sort of at the time, a slight push to move things into the commercial realm. But even then, what was called Digital Globe was still building these massive, you know, school bus sized satellites that cost hundreds of millions of dollars. And so the first sort of, you know, major, I guess, difference was a small company called Skybox that was eventually acquired by Google for $500 million. And they built a satellite the size of a dishwasher. And it was like, wow, you can produce results that can affect mission at a fraction of the price, a fraction of the size, and you can put up as many of these as you want. And once they sort of did that, many others quickly followed. And seeing and appreciating that you didn't need an exquisite system for every job, and also appreciating that having scarce resources also hindered our ability to perform analysis. And so there's a company called Black Sky, and I really love the analogy that they're going to blacken out the sky with the number of satellites they want to put overhead. And even today, when you look at like Starlink, which is the comm satellite constellation put up by SpaceX, you know, you can see those with your bare, you know, your naked eye, just, you know, string them across the, you know, the orbital path. And so appreciating that you can solve a lot of missions using less than exquisite capabilities was sort of that first sort of aha.
I think that's quite interesting. Even in terms of infrastructure, especially in the government, big budgets and very big needs, knowing that coming at it from creativity and innovation. And I wanted to ask Emma, going back in your journey, right, whether it's at Defense Innovation Unit or like some of these earlier careers, how is this experience for you when you were kind of going on to the next problem? And then you mentioned the second problem and third problem and the fourth problem. So could you kind of tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with the point that Rob made, that we are really, you know, we're in a different era of where funding is going and how much we have to put towards the technology that our national security enterprise uses. And so we have to think very differently about it. I think a really interesting aha moment for me was realizing that we're in an era of building such complex systems of systems that you have to solve way more problems in order to achieve an outcome. I mean, that may be that's probably a statement that could easily be challenged, but I guess what I mean is, you know, we have a lot of different fields that folks are expert in. And new fields are emerging that are important to a lot of the different technologies that we're trying to build. And so one of the aha moments for me was realizing that when folks were trying to solve the problem that we focus on at Kachai, they would tend to say, or they would tend to locate it in a network problem solution model, right? They would say, like, where in the OSI stack, you know, is the problem. The OSI stack is all about network. Well, you know, if you have a perfect network, you still don't solve the problem of collaborative autonomy. And so, and then they would say, okay, well, is it interoperability? Well, you know, you make that perfect, it's still a problem. You give it perfect interoperability, that doesn't solve it. Is it an AI problem? You got a lot of folks coming into the defense modernization space who are expert in AI, making each individual node very intelligent. But that still doesn't really solve a problem of making multiple entities act as one. I mean, individual humans are very intelligent, and yet we don't have a hive mind, right? And just seeing that there was a complete, one of the fields that was needed to solve this problem was just not present in the defense modernization space. And that is essentially distributed systems and distributed infrastructure and distributed cybersecurity. That was really an aha moment, because then you wonder how many other fields are well developed in the private sector, but absent in a way that people don't even realize when they're trying to solve enormous problems in the national security space, or say in, you know, other parts of government that are trying to solve problems and don't realize what they need, perhaps, that they're missing something, that they're working on the equivalent of the network improvement, when what they really need is a systems improvement. That was an aha for me, that things are so complex that sometimes you don't even realize that you're missing a field of expertise to solve a problem.
I think that contrast is quite interesting in terms of having the right expertise, as you mentioned. And I think, as kind of Rob mentioned as well, even with the infrastructure, being able to do a lot with even minimum infrastructure, things that are not even necessarily so expensive or huge or massive in their design. And so generally, like, looking at innovation, right? Because, like, we have a lot of people who are working in this field, kind of seeing those gaps, identifying those gaps. Over the span of your career, how do you think viewing innovation has kind of changed, as well as the age that we're in right now?
I'll dive in. So I entered the private sector 4 years ago, and I think one of the things I observed at the time was that the government was very much risk tolerant when it came to working with novel technologies and startups in particular. I think a lot of folks in the AI space are familiar today with a project called Project Maven out of the Pentagon. And when my company joined that contract, they were something
like... Could you explain Project Maven very briefly, whatever?
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a sort of a one-off project within the Pentagon to bring AI capabilities to the warfighter. And I say it was one-off because of the way that it was established, the way that it was funded, and it didn't fall under the normal hierarchy that you would expect. Like, it didn't start in DARPA or IARPA. Instead, it was a standalone independent organization, which gave it a lot of freedom and flexibility, which is what commanders wanted, because then they could bring in what they needed. And that was sort of the point I was getting to, is that, you know, they pulled in, you know, dozens of companies with a variety of capabilities, and that all seemed great. And they spent a lot of money and brought in a lot of capabilities, but then within a very short period of time, they just started like knocking them off. And within a really short period of time, there were only four of us left. And then we got knocked off, and then the other one got knocked off. And so I felt like in that period, you saw the pendulum swing hard to one side, where they said, yeah, we should bring in a lot of startups. And then very quickly, their timelines and getting through the valley of death did not align with startups' runways. And so they just started cutting capabilities and started, you know, canceling contracts when startups couldn't keep up with the bureaucratic machine. And, you know, a lot of those contracts went to big household name firms, and then, you know, onesie and twosie sort of startups that now today I feel like are household names. You know, companies 10 years ago, 5 years ago, like Palantir, Anduril, SpaceX, you know, people weren't really aware of what they did. But now today, everybody, I think, is tracking, at least in the defense space.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned risk tolerance, and that's one of the ways that I often think about innovation. A lot of the work that I've done in and around government has been in trying to understand the kind of little innovation subculture of defense modernization. You know, you have the giant acquisition programs that take, you know, an average of 35 years or something to go through. And then you have all the folks whose job is to try and figure out how to be innovative. And I think that one of the first one I'll make is that when you're in peacetime and you've been in peacetime for a long time, and by peacetime, I mean, our country is not under attack. We're not at risk of being overrun by an adversary. You know, when we're in that situation, you have a lot of risk aversion to process failures or process embarrassments, right? And you have a lot of risk tolerance for outcome failures. And so innovation, you know, it's hard to innovate in the direction of making the best thing for the warfighter, because the consequences that are most real and immediate are, hey, if I try something new and it fails, I'm going to get hauled in front of Congress and humiliated, you know? And so that's one of the really difficult things about innovation in this space, is that you have, you know, the CICE has a big focus on economics. The incentive structure of this whole paradigm isn't really pointed in the right direction, because the incentives are often to play it very safe. And then the second thing I'll say is, I think that, you know, you said something like, Rob, that whether the startups could keep up with the government bureaucracy, it's often the other way around. You know, can that bureaucracy keep up with the timeline that a startup needs to stay in business? And that's really, I think that's difficult for a lot of startups that are trying to do business with the government in general, but especially the DoD, because there is a sense of urgency, there is a sense of importance of what they're doing, but also, you know, it's a tough customer because the incentives are a little strange, the timelines are often slow and unpredictable. So innovation is just difficult in this space.
I would like to know more. How is selling to the government different from selling commercially? Because you spoke about keeping up with the bureaucracy, there's many regulations, you have to understand the government well. So what have those differences been, maybe in your own journey within Kachai, as well as, like, Rob, for you, when you advise startups on how to successfully kind of work with the government? So we can start with Rob here.
Sure. I think in the commercial space, frequently you're selling, you know, commercial off-the-shelf components or services that people come to you when they need something. You're very, I don't want to jump into, like, you know, developing an Uber from the ground up or something like that. But, you know, in the government space, when you're a startup, you're having to, you know, break through layers of bureaucracy, oftentimes shrouded in secrets. You know, who do you call at CIA? Like, that information isn't just readily available. You sort of have to figure your way through it. And then understanding their requirements is very difficult. And so there's a very long dating period. And, you know, very often it can be just 18 to 36 months to get a foot in the door. And then to move from an R&D contract into an O&M contract, that can be 5 years.
O&M contract is?
So research and development versus operations and maintenance. They fall into what are called colors of money, which is how Congress appropriates and authorizes spending. And so there's layers of detail there, but basically you get one or the other, and you can't use them for cross purpose without reprogramming that funding and receiving authorization from Congress to do so. And all of that should highlight the complexity and the time it takes. You know, and contrast that, of course, within a commercial sale that can take, you know, days to process. You know, you've got a thing I want, great, here's a purchase order, here's a contract, and you're off to the races. And so people who are coming from industry into government get very frustrated very quickly, not understanding why somebody won't take their phone call, or even when they have a quote good meeting, why it didn't produce anything. And I think that sort of leads into the next aspect of government acquisition, which is the requirements process that people neglect to understand, that, you know, requirements are official needs that have been authorized for purchase. And it's not just because somebody wants it. It actually has to go through a chain of command, has to have money, you know, put against it. And there's a process, and it can take a long time. You know, if you're doing it right, It's a 2-year process from sort of ideation through getting it into the president's budget request and then authorized and appropriated and then distributed out to the departments and agencies. So there's just a lot to that that people, I think, fail to recognize early on in their government engagements.
Okay. So if I was to prepare for 2027, I would have to start right now, basically, in any way, right? Any capacity, as you said, meeting those requirements and that kind of thing.
I mean, I would even say for 2027, you're late. You should have started.
Yeah. 2028, 2029.
Okay. Wow. Okay.
The Defense Department or you know, the defense modernization establishment has very little money and very little process to buy anything within 5 years of hearing about it for the first time. Right. They really do plan everything so far in advance, and Congress approves it so far in advance down to, I mean, like Rob said, the types of things that you can spend individual pots of money on that, you know, like if you walked in with an infinite energy machine or a teleportation device or a time machine, you know, and they would still take probably 5 years to find a way to actually buy it at scale, because they don't have a requirement for it already, and they haven't asked Congress to allocate resources for infinite energy stuff. And then they would have to put out a competitive call to make sure that there aren't other infinite energy machine companies. And all of this is, you know, it's all of this is well-intentioned, but it's accumulated. It's because there have been just accumulated piles and piles of process rules, each of which makes sense on its own, but when you add it all together, it makes for a system that isn't fit for purpose in this century. I mean, it was built for an era in which government really did most of the innovation in national labs, and so they knew what was coming, and they could plan to buy it when the national labs were done, you know, inventing it. And these days, you know, that whole process doesn't work if you're showing up with something that's already made and asking, hey, do you want to buy 500 of these? And they just say, well, we don't have a requirement for an infinite energy machine. You know, come back with a better version of a solar panel because we can buy that.
The irony is that they get in and convince somebody that they should buy the infinite energy machine, but it still takes 2 years to get through the PBR and appropriations process. And by that time, you've already moved on to the next evolution. It's no longer an infinite energy machine. It's now an infinite fusion, something, something generator. And the requirement comes out. You're like, but I haven't built that in 2 years. You want me to go back to a previous technology that is inferior? You know, it's a, I don't even want to call it a catch-22, I suppose, at times.
Okay. So then, how do startups, right, then how do we kind of get our foot in the door, given just the way these things are moving, and we don't want to be caught in that catch-22 situation either? What are the pathways for securing funding for a startup? And we kind of touched on the processes, like planning and a little bit of what the timelines look like. So how would it work with government contracts versus private sector or venture capital? What's kind of that first step once that idea is there, and like how do startups position themselves at that point?
Maybe Rob, you go first, because honestly, I don't know the answer yet.
I think that
part of starting a company in this space is jumping into the darkness, because you can't not do it, but knowing that there's not a well-trodden path to do it. But maybe Rob will tell me what the well-trodden path is.
Yeah, it's so I think that one of the hardest things for startups to do is to essentially slow down, take stock, do the research, and talk to as many people as possible, because none of that feels like progress. It feels like the opposite of it. And so what I frequently advocate to startups is that, you know, their first business hire is not a sales guy, it's a marketing person. Somebody who can separate it, market into segments, and not talk about total addressable market, which is a useless number that I can Google. You need to get into the serviceable, obtainable market that you're actually able to get after. And so for a startup, you know, they clearly have a product idea. They need to figure out who are the potential customers for that. And so for collaborative autonomy, you know, your work, Emma, with Army Futures Command, I was like, yeah, spot on, perfect. Because the Army is in charge of drone and counter drone systems. that sort of fits oddly into this artillery type space is how they think about it. So I think it's called the JCO. I don't remember what it stands for. And so then you need to go out and start meeting those people, and you have to go to where they are, right? You have to learn to speak their language. You have to characterize things as an infantry soldier, not as an engineer. And that's something that I frequently run up against working in engineering organizations now for 8 years. Engineers love to talk shop, but they only want to do it on their terms. And it's like, that's not going to be helpful. You really need to talk about it from a mission first perspective, and then move past not just the what and the features of your product or service. Talk about the so what and the benefit to the warfighter and accomplishing their mission. And if you can start with that and then work backwards, I think you'll get a lot more traction a lot faster. And you do that by going to conferences. Obviously, you can't do it during a government shutdown, but read trade magazines. You've got C4ISR, Defense One, Defense News. You know, go to Army's website and start digging into the commands, reading their press releases, see what their senior leadership is saying before Congress when they are advocating for their budgets. There are tons of ways to hear about this stuff and then incorporate it into your proposals and your marketing materials so that you don't come across as an other, as somebody who doesn't care about the mission. Instead, it sounds like, wow, they know us, they know our history, they know our culture, they care about us. That's somebody I'm going to talk to.
Okay, so essentially, as you said, speaking the language that the government speaks, understanding how to speak that language. And more technically, I know there's the Small Business Innovation Research, the SBIR, and the Small Business Technology Transfer, the STTR. So in terms of these two pathways, what has your experience been in dealing with this? I guess, Emma, are you in the process of using these pathways, or what are you able to tell us just about your experiences in navigating these with the government right now?
Yeah. So it's an interesting time for SBIR and what folks in the DoD call SITR, even though that's not what the acronym sounds like it would be pronounced as. You do have a proliferation of ways to easily submit them using AI and things like that, and a intense reduction of people who are evaluating them, meaning a reduction in the amount of time that they're able to spend on each one. They were never, especially for phase ones, but even for phase two SBIRs, meaning phase one are the kind of 100K, 150K range. You just have to give them an idea. Phase two is you do a lot more work, go get signatures from various people who support you. The frustration, I think, for me has always been, it's hard to know who it is that you're talking to. And so how do you grab their attention? Like, is this a maintenance officer reading this? Is this is this somebody with some tactical or strategic education? Is this somebody who needs, this part explained, or who needs this other part explained, right? And if they're only going to spend a few minutes on it, you only have a little bit of time to explain it. So I would say SBIR and SITR are really great avenues for innovations that have vivid imagery. And that's just a human thing, right? If you can explain it with pictures, you get a lot more of their attention because they've got more time left over after they understand basically what you're showing them to read about it. If you're bringing something that is more conceptual, that is software, that doesn't have a dashboard or if you're bringing something that is infrastructure, like Kachai is, you have a lot of a harder time.
Yeah, so I think SBIRs and SITRs are absolutely wonderful tools. You know, they've gotten a lot more competitive over the years. A lot more people are applying to them, but also the awards have gotten bigger as well. And so the potential impact on a company has grown sort of proportionately with them. To Emma's point about vivid imagery, that speaks to my heart. Is exactly what I was just saying. Like, you need to speak the language of the customer, and then also use pictures of the customer doing the mission that your capability supports. And so I wanted to share DVIDshub.net. That is a DoD website where they share images of them just doing stuff around the world. And there's a search tool, and you just type in airfield, drone, software, and you'll get pictures that are then relevant to your customer. And so include those in your proposal so that, to Emma's point, when a civil engineering contracting officer is surged to do cyber support and they're reading about, you know, fleet ballistic missiles or something, I don't know, you know, they can see, oh, I see what they're talking about. This thing plugs into that thing and that thing, I know what it does. So that's pretty straightforward. So yeah, imagery, I think, is a really important process. And then, you know, to Emma's point, though, that, you know, CBRS can be time intensive. What I recommend to everybody is if they are at all considering it, they should just go into the website, you know, as soon as it allows you to, because there are cohorts. Even if you don't intend to apply, open up a proposal and see what is required and start to assemble that data. So what is your EIN and what is your NASIC code? You know, who are your key performers and do you have their resumes? Do you have their bibliography of publications? Gather all this information so that when you do get a short timeline on a turnaround, you're just copying and pasting it and it's lightning fast. Then the only thing you're really working on is the tech proposal and the cost proposal. And hopefully with the, you know, modern tools that we have with LLMs, those come together a lot faster. And then it really is just a matter of, you know, is your capability compelling? But again, importantly, talk about the so what, not just the what.
Okay. So first, as you said, kind of familiarizing yourself with the materials, with the process, with the website, going over that and kind of understanding the templates. And I think one thing Emma said that I found a little interesting was who's reading this? Who are the people reading this? What are the personas of the people who you might be selling the product to? In terms of understanding that, Rob, I know that you've touched upon this and the need to understand the kind of personas of people who you might be working with. And why is this important? And what can this essentially do for a startup?
Yeah. And, you know, and to Emma's point a moment ago, so I'll just use my experience from the recent past going after what's called tactical financing, which is a subset of the CBRS program through the Air Force. And there were something like 800 applications for that one solicitation. And it was only a relatively small pot of money. And so, you know, they have to surge contracting officers to be on source selection panels, but then they should also be pulling in subject matter experts so that if you are applying to a topic on, I'll stick with civil engineering, they're bringing in AFCEC, Air Force Civil Engineering Center, to say, yes, this is something we need that would solve a problem and it would, you know, save us money, whatever it is. And then they score against a number of different criteria. And I think, you know, CBRS can be tough because frequently the topics are just a sentence or two. And so you don't really understand what the requirement is. And so that really highlights the importance during the pre-release period of reading the topics and then reaching out to the technical point of contact to understand what the requirement is. And I think one of the most critical questions is understanding, like, is this part of a larger acquisition effort or is this a one-off? And, you know, very often it's like, oh, no, it's just us. We've got some money. We're going to just try this. And it's like, okay, well, that's not part of a long-term acquisition strategy. It's a data point of where you should expect this to go and you know, how long it will take to get across the Valley of Death versus, oh, this is part of a strategic acquisition strategy of the Department of the Air Force. You're like, ooh, okay. So you guys actually already have a plan in process to take whatever it is, you know, I'm proposing and then, you know, move it into O&M again. So yeah, definitely reaching out to that technical point of contact whose name and email address, possibly phone number, should be in the instructions and to understand what those requirements really are. And then importantly, when you're putting together a proposal, is to have a compliance matrix. It's not something you submit, but it's something that you use internally to say, these are the 30 shall haves that are listed in the instructions. Have we met all of those and to the best of our ability exceeded them? And if the answer is no, you need to go back and retool how you built your proposal. And some of them, this is no kidding, you have to be specific in your font size and font choice. And if you get those wrong, you can be disqualified because they've got 800 applications they're getting through. And if you're not following the rules, if you can't get the little things right, why should they trust you with the big ones?
The attention to detail is a make or break. I definitely was not aware about this level of detail. And you've kind of come to an interesting point that I kind of wanted to address, which was for national security startups. And you've kind of touched upon this in your book, Startup Statesmanship. There are two approaches, selling the art of the possible versus selling what's ready right now. So Rob, you've said most startups should lead with the art of the possible, even though this is more long-term. Can you walk us through the trade-offs of each approach? Because if I'm selling what's possible, I don't know if there's a requirement for what's possible. How does one navigate that?
Yeah, it's a delicate balancing act, and one I'll admit I struggled with. You know, as a former intelligence officer, my job was always to speak truth to power and to be intellectually honest, to say what we know, what we don't know, and selling the art of the possible felt like lying. However, there is a difference between selling vaporware and then selling your product roadmap. And that's what I mean by the art of the possible. And if you are able to say, with this investment, with this much time and the people we have, we will go from where we are today to this capability, which will deliver X, Y, and Z functionality, they'll provide this benefit, that is very different than just selling something that doesn't work. And that's, you know, one of the major trappings is that you don't want to overpromise and under deliver. You only get one chance at it, right? And so if you promise to deliver a widget and you show up with anything less than that, they're not going to extend your contract, and then you're dead in the water. And getting back in front of that customer again is just gotten twice as hard, because why would they trust you again with their few resources? But at the same time, you know, government also is used to the exaggeration of industry. And so when they hear a message, they're going to automatically downgrade it to what they think it actually is. And so if you're coming in there talking about the science of today, but they think you're talking about the art of the possible, they're going to downgrade you to something inferior that is not what you can actually do. And when I worked at CrowdAI, we got dinged for this actually twice in the same week, one by industry and one by government, being like, you guys are doing great work. We see what you're doing, but you're selling yourselves all wrong, and it's undermining you and your ability to land contracts. And it was just like, oh my gosh, like, do I have to change my approach? And that was the major shift from intelligence officer, this is what we know, this is what we don't know, to, okay, I can sell the art of the possible as long as they understand it's part of a roadmap that they are helping us move along.
Okay, wow. In terms of advice, I can kind of see how the trade-offs can kind of differ, even as how someone's perceiving what you're saying versus what it might actually be. And Emma, I wanted to ask, in navigating your own startup, and Kachai, you said you guys are taking a break from the sibbers and the sitters. And so what kind of approaches do you guys have in mind now, like in terms of strategy?
So we're getting back into them as long as they're reauthorized and, you know, still accessible once the government reopens again. And I think that's part of the reason why is because we've realized after taking about a year off, trying a few different markets, a few different marketing strategies, that we now have one that really works and that is easy to communicate. And we've kind of honed the communication strategy. And I'll touch on the kind of art of the possible versus what we have right now. You know, that's a huge struggle, especially when you're doing deep tech, because you're telling people that you can do something that they don't really believe you can do. And so, you know, and because you're bringing, you know, if you're bringing a different area of expertise, or you've got an invention or something like that, you really do have to navigate expectations and, you know, not sound totally delusional as well. So Sibber and Sitter will be great for that. I think now that we are able to use visuals, we've got a very clear use case in the drone swarming conops. And I think that we'll be able to win those now that then give credibility when we're introducing the idea to folks and they say, do you have a Sibber or Sitter? What that really means is, should I keep listening to you? Right? And I think that that's one of the best things about that program, that you can give them an idea. And as long as it's something that they can grasp quickly without a lot of area of expertise, you might get that validation that somebody thinks they might want it, and that, hey, maybe it's possible. Because in a Sibber Sitter, you're not actually promising to deliver the capability. You are saying, I will move forward on this if you will fund us, and I will figure out how to integrate it with the strategies that you're trying to prosecute. So that's definitely on the roadmap for us. And then another is just having really figured out where do we fit in the Prime ecosystem. Like, there's never going to be a program executive office for collaborative autonomy, right? Like, that's not, they do vertically integrated capabilities. And what they want is for larger companies on the outside to kind of orchestrate all of the underlying enabling capability layers into that larger capability to then compete for it and deliver it. And so what we've realized is, okay, our customer are the Boeings and the Lockheeds and the, you know, maybe the Anduril's and AeroVironments of the world. And our customer's customer is the PEO and the requirements writer and the operator, right? They need to be influenced by us, but they're not going to buy it directly from us. Sibber Sitter is sort of asking them to send a demand signal, but it's not the step towards them buying it directly from us, because the government doesn't just buy like enabling software and then build its own things itself. And so we've got kind of this two-pronged approach where we have to influence our customers' customers.
I think there's two really important points, though. When Emma's customer says, oh, do you have a Sibber? There's also some underlying questions that I think are critically important for understanding why Sibbers and Sitters are so valuable. And number one is that, you know, appreciate that they are a carve out within the federal acquisition, structure, so that when you win an SBIR, you have the authority for sole source award. You don't have to go through, you know, public competition again. And so the specific language is, if your project completes, extends, or is otherwise derived from an SBIR, you are authorized for sole source. And that's all you need for your JOFOC, which is your justification for other than open competition. And so that is huge, right? So when somebody says, oh, do you have a Sibber? It's like, do we have authorization to buy you sole source, or do we have to go compete this, which is going to add months to this process? So that's number one. And then the second one is that when you win an SBIR topic, there is a non-disclosure agreement between you and the government for that requirement, meaning that the government can't go solicit that publicly again. They have to come through you first. And so, you know, Dema's point about working with a prime, that becomes very powerful, because there are plenty of primes out there who will work with startups to learn their innovative claims and then take that work for themselves and try to poach the staff that was originally doing it, you know, for the startup. And that's their business model. And I've seen it plenty of times. And so at least having the protections of the non-disclosure agreement means that working through a channel partner, that channel partner can't go say, hey, I'd like to do this for you better, faster, cheaper, government. The government still has to come to the startup. And so there are implied protections that are, I think, really critical to a healthy startup ecosystem that Sibber and Sitter provide.
Okay. You've mentioned kind of protecting your intellectual property, your IP within this process as well, through the Sibber and Sitter. Are there any other kind of advices that you would give for startups navigating this space on how they can effectively do that? Because there's so many different moving components and pieces that you're working with. And Emma, you mentioned your customer's customer. Even getting into that kind of relationships, what has been your navigating toolkit that's kind of helped you in this space?
Yeah, so I would say the first thing to realize probably is that there is an abundance of excellent ideas and inventions and technologies that work relative to the abundance of startup founders who are going to be able to take it to market. And one of the first things that I learned when I went into startup space working for a different startup is, look, you know, your idea isn't actually worth anything if it's not making you money, if you're not building a business around it, right? And that was kind of a big realization for me. And somebody once told me, and it's, you know, you don't want to take this too far, but it's a bit of a, you know, when you're very excited about your technology, your invention, your idea, you can start to think like that's what this is. And if somebody else gets a hold of it, then I'll be out of business. Or if somebody else comes up with a competing product that does something similar, I'll be out of business. It's really much more about execution. And so, I mean, what that means is you have to be good at execution. If you have the idea and you can't execute, that's not success. And there are way more of those than you might think. There's actually lots of ideas and inventions and technologies that are available in, you know, for technology transfer that need founders to go and use them to build companies and products and provide those ideas and inventions to the warfighter. They're in universities and labs. What the scarcity really is execution. And so it's not that IP isn't important, but it's often less important than people realize because, you know, the value a startup eventually creates, I think, is much more about how they manage to communicate the value of what they have, how they manage to get customers and keep the customers and position themselves relative to things that it's favorable to them to position themselves against, as opposed to positioning themselves against things that are better or harder to compete with. There's so much strategy that goes into this, and then the execution, right? So I guess that's like, absolutely get patents, you know, trademark your stuff, do all of that process. But the most insightful thing that I've heard and learned is, hey, it's, you know, that gets more attention than maybe it needs relative to, can you sell something?
And I agree on the patent side. Like, you know, when you do that, you reveal what it is you're doing so other people can learn from it, and you don't want to do that. But I think there's also things that you can do inside of your agreements with, say, channel partners, like teaming agreements that have non-compete clauses, so that if they do compete with you, you can take legal action against them. I think, you know, one of the challenging things that startups have is the lack of name recognition and therefore the lack of trust on the government side. And the government, you know, has these long-standing relationships with their primes who sit inside the vault with them. And even at water cooler talk, it's, hey, you know, hey, what do you think of this company? And it only takes one person to be like, yeah, I looked at their stuff, it's garbage. And then that govvy's like, well, it must be garbage. I trust my prime. And what you don't know is that prime is also developing a competitive capability, and they're trying to then get it through, you know, the procurement process. And so you have to be very careful about your reputation and protecting it. And I think talking to an IP attorney and understanding sort of like lanes in the road and how to protect yourself is important. There's a company called Scale LLP that I've worked with in the past. Eric Blatt is the guy's name. And he's very good at, you know, not bending startups over a barrel financially, but asking really, you know, critical questions. And I think, as we sort of touched on a moment ago, is like this idea of like innovative claims, where your innovative claims are what distinguish you from your competitors. And so if they know what those are because you're trying to sell yourself to them in a sort of like a business development meeting, they can then undermine you in their own proposals or mitigate your claims somehow. And so I don't know that every solicitation will allow it, but some of them will allow you to provide a proprietary annex that doesn't go through the prime. It goes directly to the government. At least that would be one way to protect those innovative claims or your wrap rates or whatever it is that could be used anti-competitively by a prime.
Okay. And could you elaborate, what is a proprietary annex?
Oh, so like, you know, an annex would just be something you staple on the back end of your proposal. It's not part of the traditional tech volume or cost volume. Proprietary meaning that it is data that is unique to your firm that is somehow controlled or otherwise sensitive. And you'll have to, you know, Google that and or talk to an IP lawyer about, you know, what is characterized as proprietary. But I've always believed strongly that innovative claims, pricing, unless you have like a public price list, your pricing structure, those are things that can be used against you to undermine your business and therefore should fall under the protections of proprietary information.
Okay. I feel like we're kind of going into understanding your product and then also understanding the market for it, even when it, as you said, comes to innovative claims and pricing. And I kind of wanted to touch up just briefly on kind of assessing this product market fit. And I know this kind of comes in around the requirement stage and you're having those ideas. What are some easy ways to go about the execution or the thinking about it that just gives more clarity? Emma, how has your experience kind of been?
So product market fit, it really comes down to, do you understand your customer? And so there's also product founder fit. Our product, you know, folks are like, oh, have you thought about taking that to finance, right? High frequency trading would really love this, the underlying tech behind what you do. And I say, cool, you know, can you introduce me to someone in high frequency trading? Because I don't know them and I don't know their problem. I can look it up, but I don't know what it feels like to them when the distributed system infrastructure doesn't work or isn't there, right? How much money do they lose per second? What's the punishment to them personally? You know, is this something that they feel in a visceral sense? And I just don't know the answer to those questions. And so there may well be product market fit, but there isn't product founder fit. And then, you know, where my network and knowledge is really in, how do you win wars according to the best concepts and strategies that we have and that the services are embracing? And there I can make a really clear case for why this helps you win a war. Now, a lot of startups will have some version of this problem where it's conceptually it makes sense in a world where, you know, in a world where there were only one set of incentives, that would be a shoo-in. But there are a whole set of incentives that inform the modernization enterprise for the services and the DoD that are not really about actually winning the next war, that are really much more about process, that are much more about working with Congress, much more about the rules of how you can spend money. And so, you know, there's a whole other product market fit job for me to do there of whose job is hard right now that using this technology would make it a lot easier, right? Who needs distributed systems infrastructure in order to deliver on the requirement that they have? Even though the requirement doesn't say distributed systems infrastructure, it says your system needs to do X, Y, and Z without Q, right? So finding product market fit in this industry is finding, you know, it could be bureaucrats, it could be military leadership, it could be contracting officers who have some kind of problem that it's actually, you know, you step back and it's not obvious that would be your market, but it is, because, you know, the thing they're looking for is solved by the thing that you're providing. So it takes a lot of work. This is an industry to get into where you have to be motivated by a lot of intangible, you know, patriotism and kind of internal motivation, because there's a lot of product market fit work to do that is a little bit illogical at times and takes a lot of effort and attention.
Throughout this conversation, there's just so much information coming in, and I can see how long term this process is at every point of time, because you don't really know if you cross any valleys of death. You're doing it and you're motivated, but you're also adapting to the changing environment within the government situation. And there seems like there's a lot of possible ways to also steer off course. I kind of wanted to wrap this up with addressing what are the most common pitfalls that startup founders should be aware of. And then lastly, you guys spoke about how there are a lot of ideas out there. There's a lot of innovation out there, but they're looking for executors who can kind of put this through. So what are kind of those innovative or emerging technologies that the audience should be aware of or like do research of that could help them learn more about a gap or that could help them in their journey? And Rob, if you would like to address.
Sure. I think actually Emma touched on it really well earlier, and she said it a little bit differently, but essentially, if you're not making sales, you don't have a product, you have a science project, is sort of like that major pitfall. Like if nobody's buying what you're selling, you need to think really hard about whether or not you can realistically create a market for what you're selling, or if you need to pivot. And both of those are very difficult tasks. There is no panacea. I don't know how to answer that question. Only a founder and their advisors will know how to do that. But being unwilling to have that conversation on principle is a major pitfall. Like if you exist to, you know, if company A exists to do service B and company A doesn't exist without service B, then it's like, well, you have to be a little more flexible that if you want to survive. And then in terms of, you know, where people should be looking for understanding emerging trends, you know, I think certainly listening to what's coming out of the White House and press releases out of the Pentagon, you know, there's a lot of chaff out there, but there's also a lot of good wheat as well. And so, you know, obviously drones are very big in what's going on in the Ukrainian conflict, but also what's going on with Golden Dome and hypersonics. Those are all things that people talk about in the media. I think if somebody wanted to, you know, really learn sort of the details of how, you know, these technologies are trending, at least in real world use cases, is to, you know, go to the subreddit that is tracking the Ukraine conflict, and you can watch the videos and see how the technology is evolving on the battlefield in real time. And I remember the first time I saw the Russians using fiber optics, miles of fiber optics, to mitigate the counter UAS capabilities that the Ukrainians were employing at the time. And now, just within the last week or so, I saw a picture where they have these drone corridors so that vehicles can drive down the highway and not worry about getting hit by a drone. And they're just draped in what looks like spider webs. And it's all the fiber optic cable because they are using so much of it on the battle space now. You know, and it's just not something I ever imagined that there would be that much fiber optic. It's not even cable. It's a single filament. You know, it's, you know, like a silken thread. And so, you know, if you're going to be, I think, conversational in these topics, you really need to be watching that sort of first person perspective and then to do it over a period of time so that you can speak intelligently about those emerging capabilities in a way that is not just superficial.
So that's great. Emma, do you have any thoughts as well?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, just search the words lab technology transfer and you get a bunch of different entities from the government that have, you know, technology that you can license as a small business and then build something around it. It's a underutilized resource. And then honestly, what I would say is if you are a technologist, make friends with people who are more strategic and big picture and executive, right? Develop relationships with people who bring the piece of the puzzle that you don't. Recognize that you, one person alone, probably doesn't have all of the skill sets needed to bring something from 0 to 10 or from 0 to 1. And if you are if you want to be a founder, go make friends with people who are, you know, getting their PhDs and doing interesting science, because they may not realize the value of what they're doing. A lot of the times the folks who tend to go into PhDs are, you know, it's a different type of person. It's somebody who's wanting to push the ball forward on a very, very specific and narrow scientific plane, but they get to talking with you and then both of you realize, oh, wow, like this solves a problem. And here's where we could bring it, and they might fund even further development. And it's that synergy between different types of people that I think makes for a successful startup founding team. But one of the biggest challenges that I see startups having is when you have a technical CEO who doesn't have the counterpart who isn't deep in the tech, and then they have a hard time accessing the mindset of somebody who's not technical and somebody who has the problem but not the solution, right? Or when you have, you know, a founding team that doesn't have the technical chops to do what they advertised that they were going to do. Yeah, I would say that those are some classic pitfalls that people fall into. And then just, you know, running out of money, not watching your burn rate, the amount of money that you spend each month, you know, expecting the deals that you've started to complete and go through and pay you, right? Because you do have to accept a whole lot of negative surprise. And then that positive move takes you very far, but you don't know when it's going to happen. And so you know, really just making sure that you're raising enough money to cover yourself for enough time for one of those, you know, lucky breaks to come through. And then just have a lot of resilience when things are difficult, when you lose a deal and you don't know why, when some policy change or a government shutdown or something gets in the way of what you'd been planning on. You know, just having a lot of resilience to the ups and downs, I think, is that's another challenge that I've seen founders have.
That was extremely insightful. I'm sure the people who are listening to this, this is like huge brain dump on them, but I'm really glad. A lot of these processes, I'm sure, are very new. I want to thank you guys, Rob and Emma, for joining us on the Small World Big Problems podcast. Your journeys have kind of shown how innovation and public services come together to shape the face and future of national security. And also, I do want to point out to the audiences watching this that there's a PAVA Center for Entrepreneurship, Johns Hopkins, that does have grants and different curriculums for students who want to get started here as well. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us on Small World, Big Problems. We hope you found today's conversation as fascinating and useful as I did. If you're interested in launching your own national security venture, visit pavacenter.jhu.edu. For more discussions on strategy, policy, and security, follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. This episode was edited by Vishal Gogusetti, and this has been a production of the Johns Hopkins Size Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C.